From Feature Story News in Washington, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, Pakistan counts the cost after the Taliban strike at Karachi International Airport, sparking a six-hour firefight for its control. Housing activists speak out after a luxury apartment building in London lays down spikes to prevent the homeless from sleeping outside it.
The aim has to be to help people move in, not just to move people on.
Bryan Cranston celebrates success at the Tony Awards for his portrayal of Lyndon Baines Johnson.
To all the fellow actors in this category, I am deeply honored to be in your company. Oh boy.
And the plight of less fortunate actors struggling to make ends meet in the changing world of global entertainment. That's all ahead on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The United States is condemning an attack on Pakistan's busiest airport, which has led to 27 deaths. The Pakistani Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack, and the U.S. has offered assistance in the investigation. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
Gun battles with a group of 10 militants armed with automatic weapons, rocket-propelled grenades and suspected suicide belts in Karachi Airport went on for 5 hours. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf condemned the attack.
We have offered assistance to the relevant Pakistani authorities investigating this crime. I don't have any update for you on whether or not we're actually providing anything. To my knowledge, we're not. But broadly speaking, we work very closely with the Pakistani government on counterterrorism.
The attack on Pakistan's biggest city and commercial hub is one of several recent terrorist attacks, a sign of the apparent failure of peace talks with the Taliban, and as government airstrikes targeting these groups have intensified.
Despite a ban by the UN's International Court of Justice, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says the country plans to do what it can to move forward with its annual whale hunt in the Antarctic. In March, the UN shot the hunt down, ruling that it did not qualify as scientific research. But Shinzo Abe says he will do what he can to keep it going. He says it's regrettable that this part of Japanese culture is so misunderstood. Australia brought about the case against Japan in 2010. The International Court of Justice says Japan's killed 3,600 mink whales since 2005 under the Antarctic Whaling Program. Officials in the U.S. state of Nevada have identified the couple who shot two police officers and a civilian over the weekend in Las Vegas. Following a search of their apartment, it appears the couple was planning some sort of attack on a courthouse. Our correspondent Priscilla Huff has an update.
The last social media posting by Jared and Amanda Miller reads, "The dawn of a new day. May all our coming sacrifice be worth it." The pair shot two police officers eating lunch at a pizza buffet place, covering one body with a yellow flag reading, "Don't tread on me," and placing a manifesto with a swastika on them. They then crossed the street to Walmart, where they shot another man who confronted them. Las Vegas Sheriff Doug Gillespie says well-trained police officers cornered the couple inside the store.
"You used your training and good sense and developed a plan that forced the two suspects into a situation where their only avenue was to take their own lives."
According to a box of documents stored at a neighbor's apartment, the Millers intended to attack a courthouse and kill additional public officials.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The world's oldest man has died in New York City. The retired chemist and parapsychologist Alexander Imich was 111 years old when he died on Sunday. He was born in Poland but fled to America after World War II. Metro workers in the Brazilian city of Sao Paulo have voted to stay on strike in a move that threatens travel chaos during the Soccer World Cup. The industrial dispute comes with the country's largest city preparing to host the tournament's opening match on Thursday. Organizers FIFA are also battling to ensure the competition is not overshadowed by corruption allegations around the winning Qatari bid to host the 2022 tournament. But when it comes to the soccer, teams are arriving in Brazil ahead of their opening games. Mick Dennis, Daily Express soccer correspondent, says the England team managed by Roy Hodgson may not be hot favorites, but are quietly confident.
"Just a feeling of a group of players focused on playing football this time. It's an amorphous thing. I can't really explain. It just feels better.
And a court in Moscow has sentenced two men to life sentences for the murder of prominent journalist Anna Politkovskaya in 2006. The men were earlier acquitted, but the country's Supreme Court ordered a retrial. Anya Ardayeva reports from the Russian capital.
Anna Politkovskaya, an investigative reporter and critic of the Kremlin's actions in Chechnya, was shot dead in an elevator of her apartment building in October of 2006. Rustam Mahmudov was found guilty of pulling the trigger. His uncle, Lomali Gutukayev, was found guilty of organizing the crime. Both men received life sentences. The other three, including two Mahmudov brothers, were given between 12 and 20 years in prison. A total of five men were convicted of the crime in May. Three of them had earlier been acquitted. However, the country's Supreme Court ordered a retrial.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports.
This is Radio Pakistan. The special assistant to the Prime Minister, Shujaat Azim, has said the Karachi airport will be made operational by 4 p.m. today. He said security has been enhanced at all the airports. Earlier, Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif had directed the concerned authorities to reopen the Karachi airport without any further delay.
Radio Pakistan announcing the news today that an armed siege of Karachi airport had been brought to a close by commandos with the Pakistani army, but at an enormous price. At least 28 people are now known to have died after heavily armed gunmen breached a cargo facility at the airport and launched an attack against a VIP terminal. A six-hour firefight left all 10 militants dead, but also 18 others, most of them believed to be members of the airport's security team. The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the assault. Journalist Hassan Abdullah in Karachi spoke to Patrick Fock of regional broadcaster Channel News Asia.
The army officials are saying that at least 23 people have been killed throughout this attack. They're saying that around 11 of them were attackers. Very interestingly, some of the security officials have told us that they found Indian arms and ammunition on the militants, on the bodies of the militants. So there is this indirect suggestion that there may have been some link of the attackers with the neighbouring country India. But again, at the moment, there's no official word on that. This is what security officials are telling us. Also, at the same time, they are combing through the airport area. The flights have not been resumed yet, and they're saying that it may take another 6 or 7 hours before the flights are actually resumed. Most of the people have now, the passengers who had been stranded within the terminal, they have now left the area. But the outer cordon is still there and people are not being allowed to enter the terminal building.
All right. Well, certainly some questions are going to be raised there. Now, the government was apparently aware of the possibility of an attack. Why was security not boosted at the airport? It's not very easy for the attackers to get in through the fence.
That's right, Patrick. There had been intelligence reports saying that following the virtual collapse of the peace talks, the Taliban were going to step up their attacks, particularly in cities like Karachi and Lahore. But despite these intelligence reports, a number of questions are being raised now as to why there has been no security beef up at the airport. Because when the attacks had started, even at that point in time, a number of people are pointing out that the response time had been very slow, and it seems that the situation was only brought under control when the army actually moved in. And before that, there was absolute chaos. So there are a number of questions that are being raised, and it seems that there would have to be some probes that would have to be carried out in search for answers.
Hassan Abdullah in Karachi speaking to Patrick Fock earlier today on regional broadcaster Channel News Asia. At the State Department in Washington, spokeswoman Marie Harf with the U.S. government's response.
Extend our condolences to the families and friends of the victims of the terrorist attacks on Karachi's international airport. And join the Pakistani people in condemning these attacks. We have offered assistance to the relevant Pakistani authorities investigating this crime. I don't have any update for you on whether or not we're actually providing anything. To my knowledge, we're not. But broadly speaking, we work very closely with the Pakistani government on counterterrorism to help them build their capacity and to work with them on a wide range of threats. We have said, of course, we're concerned about different groups operating there, including the Pakistani Taliban. But we do know the Pakistani government has a responsibility and an obligation to protect its citizens and to take appropriate counterterrorism measures. I'm not going to comment one way or the other on all of the specific airstrikes you referenced, but we do think that they have a responsibility to do so.
And there are reports today of tens of thousands, something like 25,000 Pakistanis having fled north with Waziristan, fearing that there's going to be an imminent ground assault. Do you have information on that? Are you concerned about that?
I don't have information on that. I've seen some of the reports that are out there. Obviously, as the Pakistanis undertake counterterrorism operations, we've worked with them, or at least advised them, I guess, to take civilian life into account, as we, of course, do.
So, but if you've got thousands of people fleeing out of the area, mm-hmm. they're obviously concerned about being caught up in the crossfire of this battle between the Pakistani authorities and the TTP.
That may be the case. I can't obviously get into their heads or speak for them. But look, again, the onus here is on these terrorist groups that to lay down their arms, to stop attacking innocent Pakistani and other civilians. And the government, you know, without endorsing what they're doing or giving a commentary on it anyway, one way or the other, look, they have a responsibility to protect their citizens.
Marie Harf, a spokeswoman at the State Department, talking about yesterday's deadly attack on Karachi International Airport. This is FSN Reports. London's colourful and conservative mayor found himself speaking out today on an issue that has suddenly dominated the front pages of Britain's newspapers. Boris Johnson condemned the installation of a set of metal studs outside a fashionable London apartment block. They're designed to prevent homeless people from sleeping on the sidewalk. And one British homeless charity has called them brutal. But some residents of the building are unmoved and say they approve of the measure. From FSN's London Bureau, Ollie Barrett reports.
The 1.5-inch spikes or studs are embedded in the pavement directly outside an apartment building in South London. Residents say they appeared several weeks ago after someone had been sleeping rough in the space in front of the block. But a photo taken by a social media user at the weekend swirled across the internet and made it a major talking point here in the UK. Tom Swarbrick has been speaking with people who live there.
The problem is that it's right up by the entrance to these fairly upmarket flats, so it's not necessarily the image that the owners of the building would quite like. So they've installed 19 1.5-inch spikes, not sharp enough to pierce skin, but certainly massively uncomfortable. They were installed a few weeks ago. This is what the residents make of them.
I just think they're a bit extreme, to be honest.
Have you seen people sleeping rough out here?
Yes, before they were put in.
So it has done its job?
Yes, it has.
Did you want them to leave?
I didn't request them. I think it was the first time I've seen it around here, so I was a little bit shocked to see them.
I haven't personally seen any, but I noticed these spikes came up about a month ago.
What did you think of them?
I think they're a bit harsh. I think it's quite unnecessary. I don't mind. Yeah. Really having rough sleepers, sleeping ears, as long as they don't leave a mess, which I didn't really notice anyway.
Homeless charities warn the spikes will simply move the problem elsewhere rather than solve it. Howard Sinclair is from homeless charity St Mungo's.
The aim has to be to help people move in, not just to move people on, which ultimately doesn't solve the problem, doesn't help people and won't help them. It's just circulating people around London. The aim has got to be to make sure that the services are provided as swiftly as possible to people on the streets before they become entrenched in a lifestyle, so we can get them in, we can help them and we can try and deal with their vulnerabilities.
Mayor of London Boris Johnson says the developer should move the spikes as soon as possible and that they are ugly and self-defeating. Luke used to be homeless himself. He agrees with the mayor.
Putting those spikes up just equates them to animals, you know. I have been up homeless. I was treated like subhuman, basically. Where people saw me, looked at me, it just takes a simple look, really.
But despite the difficulty in obtaining reliable figures on rough sleepers, most parties agree the numbers on UK streets have risen significantly in recent years. Ollie Barrett, London.
We spend the rest of the programme in the world of the arts, looking first at a success on the Broadway stage, then at the struggles many actors go through to earn a living. First, the success story. The Tony Awards in New York last night celebrated achievements on The Great White Way. A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder won the Tony for Best Musical. Audra McDonald was named Best Actress for her portrayal of Billie Holiday in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. And Neil Patrick Harris took home the award for Best Actor in a Musical for playing Hedwig in Hedwig and the Angry Inch. The Tony for Best Actor went to Bryan Cranston, the star of television's Breaking Bad, for his performance as Lyndon Baines Johnson in All the Way, Robert Schenken's drama, which also took the Tony for Best Play. So we thought we'd give you another chance to hear Bryan Cranston talk about the challenges playing the role. He spoke a few weeks ago with Jeffrey Brown of the PBS NewsHour.
This is the most important election of your lifetime, and the choices couldn't be clearer.
Lyndon Johnson, ambitious, impatient, tortured and troubled in a million different ways, all captured by actor Bryan Cranston.
This ain't about the Constitution. This is about those who got more, wanting to hang on to what they got.
The play called All the Way opened on Broadway in March. Written by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Robert Schenken, it's a look back at the year 1964, President Johnson's first year in office after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. A tumultuous time for the presidency and the entire nation.
We got people in this country living in unbelievable poverty. Yeah. I know. I grew up like that in the hill country.
I saw you last night, and I saw this character, you know, neck out, shoulders up.
That was my version of LBJ. I mean, it really is a version of him, because you don't want to try to take on the character specifically in the sense that to do an impersonation. You know, I just want to get the sense of who he is and allow that the character just to be absorbed into me, you know, and so I'm able to then let him loose on stage.
Cranston said he prepared for the role by visiting Johnson's presidential library in Austin and reading from the many books written on him. He also listened to some of the former president's recorded phone conversations.
You and I are buddies now, and you understand politics, and I do too, and I'm telling you that we're working with the Republicans up there 100%.
What do you think of this civil rights bill of mine?
Much of the play focuses on the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, part of Johnson's legacy of legislative achievement that's being remembered and celebrated now, 50 years later, and before he was worn down and, for many, tarnished by the Vietnam War.
Do you feel yourself part of that, looking back at the legacy and therefore some responsibility to telling that history?
Well, there's a certain amount of ownership that happens when you take on a character. You absorb as much source material as you possibly can. It's like you're making a bouquet. You're taking bits and pieces from each material that resonate with you, and you're crafting your own LBJ or whomever that character would be.
That resonate with you in some way. Yeah. What does that mean?
Well, knowing that I physically have to be up on that stage and presenting this text, as it were, you take bits and pieces of information that make sense to you, that make you realize, oh, there's interesting things. For instance, I don't even know where I read it, but he had a standing appointment to get a massage every night at the White House. And he called it a rub down. He'd get himself a rub down. And that informed a couple things. I said, he must have been tightly wound. And so I gave him a back issue in the play.
Are you saying?
Indeed, the physical transformation Cranston goes through is striking. Back bent, shoulders hunched, face scrunched, as Johnson cajoles, sweet talks, and threatens legislators to get his way, the famous Johnson treatment. As here with his future vice president, Hubert Humphrey.
This is about votes. You know that's a problem with you liberals. You don't know how to fight. You want to get something done in the real world, Hubert, you're going to have to get your hands wet. Now you call yourself the leader of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party and show me some goddamn leadership!
You're doing that, you know, towering, all looking down. And yeah. Is that fun to do?
It's a lot of fun to do.
Is it?
Sure. Anytime a man could boastfully be intimidating, yeah. You know, that's fun to do.
The now Tony Award-winning Bryan Cranston talking there to Jeffrey Brown on the PBS NewsHour. You can see more of that interview and all the rest of the NewsHour's arts coverage online at pbs.org. We close tonight with a look at the economic challenges facing many who have chosen a life treading the boards. It is not a new issue.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage. The profession is overcrowded, and the struggle's pretty tough. And admitting the fact she's burning to act, that isn't quite enough.
Noel Coward there warning Mrs. Worthington not to put her daughter on the stage as early as 1933. Now, 81 years later, the British Labour Union, representing actors, has launched a new campaign in a bid to secure the country's thespians a fairer shake. New research suggests that last year, the average actor in Britain earned just £5,000. That's about $8,000. Malcolm Sinclair is an actor and the president of the labour union Equity.
No, they're very discouraging, especially if you're about to leave drama school or a university drama department. They're very discouraging. They're not a surprise. Equity itself did a survey and found very, very, very similar results. And anecdotally, we were hearing from, you know, people who just left drama school saying they're teachers and tutors had been, you know, warning them that they weren't expected to earn any money for, you know, for the first two or three years. So, you know, the whole entertainment world has changed because, you know, everything online now, there's so many much more mechanical media, people making their own entertainment, the rise of reality TV. I think there's less drama on the broadcasting channels. And there's certainly less regional theatre. I mean, London is still going very well. Manchester goes well. Scottish cities go very well. But, you know, out in the region, you know, some theatres are struggling.
That's Malcolm Sinclair of the Actors' Union Equity. Carol Allen is a London-based director, writer and theatre producer. And to pay actors in her current production of The Merchant of Venice, she began a Kickstarter campaign online. She spoke about the economic challenges facing the world of drama to Clive Bull of Britain's LBC Radio.
I have a lot to do with actors, and most of them just don't make a living. And a lot of them are very, very talented. And when they do get work, it's usually, well, quite often, no pay or low pay. And even then, there's a lot of competition for that. And it's bad for men, but it's particularly bad for women. And it's frustrating, I find, to see so much talent not getting a chance. And it's not actually just the unknown actors. For example, there was a story in the press a couple of months ago. The actress Hermione Norris, who was a regular on the series Spooks, and she was in Crimson Field, the recent telly about nurses in the First World War, she was quoted as saying she had to watch the pennies and go to the cost-cutting supermarkets to make ends meet. It's becoming a hobby job for those with wealthy parents, or it's something you have to take time off from the day job to do because so few actors earn enough to pay the rent. I mean, supposing you were a qualified accountant or a mechanical engineer and you were doing your job for no pay and working in a supermarket or a call centre to pay the bills, that's where a lot of actors find themselves. Mm.
Do you think it is because it is so star orientated now that the big money goes to the big names and nobody else gets a look in?
I think that is partly it. I mean, there was another news story, I think it might have been yesterday, about how the production companies, the BBC used, the drama in this instance, used the same small pool of top agents and top casting directors who used the same people. Now, they cited David Tennant and Olivia Colman, probably because of Broadchurch. Well, I think they're both very good actors.
Mm.
But there are a lot of other actors who are in the position, I'm sure, that those two actors were when they were very young. Now, the other aspect is there are so many actors flooding the market now. Now, when I went to drama school, so long ago I'm not even going to mention, you had to really get into one of the five top drama schools, and then you couldn't get a job without a union card, an equity card, and you couldn't get a card until you'd landed a job. Well, along came Margaret Thatcher, and she put a stop to the closed shop, so if you could get a job, you didn't need a card. But the other thing is there's a huge rise in the number of courses being offered. Now, drama is now a university degree course. So people go and do a course at a university, not necessarily Oxford, Cambridge or anything like that, and they come out and they are putting themselves out as actors. Some are very talented, some are not very talented. You don't really know until you try and work with them or at least audition them. And even the drama schools are now offering far more courses, you know, one-year courses, evening courses, specialist in musicals or classical or whatever. There are too many actors.
Yeah, that is a part of the problem. But Equity is saying that a lot of these younger actors are being exploited by small theatres, small productions, because they're just not paying them properly or not paying them at all.
Well, they're talking about people like me, of course.
Yes.
Now, I made two films where I didn't pay anybody. I financed everything myself. They all did it for love, they all got well-fed and well-loved, and they all got copies of the film, which is very important for showreels. That's the examples of your work.
So that's not exploitation, then? That's sort of giving them a chance, would you say?
Well, that was the hope, and also, I wanted to get these films made. After that, I said, no, I'm never again going to do that. Once is enough. Now, on the show that I'm doing, for example, we raised money for the production by conducting a Kickstarter campaign and passing the hat round. But the actual bums on seats money from the box office we have earmarked for the actors and the crew. It won't be very much, but at least it is something. There is this idea of fat cat producers who are exploiting actors and, taking all the money themselves and not even paying their actors a national minimum wage. I'm sure there are some, but a lot of that's a myth. Even if you're a producer in the West End, I now realise producing is jolly hard work, and it's not a guaranteed, like being an actor, it's not a guaranteed income. You've got to find the money. You've got to get the right cast, you've got to find a venue, you've got to do all your sums. When we were looking for venues for this show, for example, we have found the Drayton Arms, which is probably the cheapest, one of the cheapest fringe theatres in London. Other ones we were looking at, 50 seaters charging £1,000 or more a week. We'll do the sums. There isn't going to be any profit, even if you fill every seat in the house. Certainly the ones... in the smaller venues, they're working very, very hard to actually make a living along with the actors.
What would your advice be to young people thinking, I fancy having a go at acting then? Would you tell them to think very carefully about it?
If somebody goes into acting thinking, oh, I'm going to become a star instantly and earn lots of money and be a household name, well, that's a bit like winning the national lottery. But most of the actors I know, they don't really care whether they become stars or not at this stage. They just want to earn a living doing what they're doing.
That's director, writer and theatre producer Carol Allen talking to Clive Bull on Britain's LBC Radio. The last word goes to Noel Coward.
No more buts, Mrs. Worthington. Nuts, Mrs. Worthington. Don't put your daughter on the stage.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks, alongside Rebecca Foster at the Bulletin Desk. Don't forget, you can let us know what you think of the programme. Drop us an email at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. For everyone with FSN everywhere, thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow. Till then, goodbye.